This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comic Jimmy Tingle left the club scene for the stage, where he has more freedom to do his kind of material. His one-man show is being held over in Boston at the Hasty Pudding Theater. Those of us outside of Boston will soon be able to hear it on a CD called Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense. The show is part social and political satire and part autobiography. It's also about his style of comedy.
My name is Jimmy Tingle, and that is my real name. And I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts, originally. And I hope everybody here enjoys the discussion of politics, society, and life in general, as seen through the stained glass windows of my soul. Because quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, I have very few jokes.
Jimmy Tingle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Jimmy, how would you describe your show and how it compares to, say, just doing stand-up?
Well, the show is, it's been a work in progress for about 5 years, and it's basically social and political humor with an autobiographical through line. It's not just about the political and social issues at hand in the world, but it's also my reaction to them and how those issues affect me.
Now, have you done this in comedy clubs or mostly in more theatrical kind of settings?
I started out in comedy clubs. I tried to do it in comedy clubs, but certain material just was not appropriate for comedy clubs. There's a piece in the show about drinking, about beer drinking, and, you know, and how it starts off very glorious and a lot of fun, and then it can turn ugly with some people, as it did with me. But anyway, when I would do that in the clubs, you know, the waitresses would be, the cash register wasn't ringing, they weren't selling any drinks, the club owners pacing back and forth. And so they said, Jim, you know, we really think the piece is great for theater, but could you take it out of the show for the comedy club? We're losing money. So not all of the material was really appropriate for comedy clubs.
Did you take it out?
They gave me a comedy club fee, and I did take it out for that week. And I aspire to go to theaters. They paid me to take it out, is what I'm saying.
Wow. Yeah,
Jim, we'll give you more money if you take out the piece.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good way to make a living. Here's some jokes.
Yeah.
Okay, I won't tell them. Now you can pay me. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we hear an excerpt of your show that has to do with drinking? And
sure.
Since we're not serving drinks to our audience, I think this will be okay.
No matter who you are in the making of beer, no matter how you feel in the making of beer, drinking when you're seasick, drinking when you can't sleep, you know that feeling? You know that feeling? Some of you know that feeling. Stomach growling, head is spinning, hands are shaking, body sweating through the sheets. You're way too paranoid to sleep. Get out of bed and find an occasion to drink the beer. Birthdays, weddings, wakes, funerals, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Bar mitzvah, bowling, a confirmation, a dedication, season's greetings, divorce hearings. We won the game. We lost the game. The game got rained out. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, New Year's Eve, Monday morning, after court, before drunk driving school. You can have a beer.
It's Jimmy Tingle from his one-man show and his forthcoming CD. Jimmy, when did you stop drinking?
Let's see, 88, in September of 88.
So you were already performing when you stopped drinking?
Yeah. Yeah, I had been doing comedy about 7 years. And, you know, in the beginning, of course, it was fine. But, I mean, drinking with me was a thing we picked up as a teenager. And it was just kind of became a way of life and became a habit that was just kind of a way of life. And so when I started doing comedy, it just fit right in with the whole scene. And in the beginning, it's, you know, it works for you in a way, but after a while, it started to work against me. It's very difficult to write new material when you're asleep. It's very difficult to want to get up.
Right.
And, you know, and want to get up and, you know, look at the day and attack the day and have your mind clear and fresh and clean and, you know, to write, to create, to just show up on time at the show. Little things that are kind of important. And so all those reasons, plus just the overall feeling of my personal life, was just, it just took a big toll on me. And I just wanted to get rid of it. You know, I just tried to get away from it, basically.
Would you usually have a drink with you on stage when you were performing?
Yeah. Yeah. But see, the thing is, and I used to think it was just because, well, you know, I read an article with George Carlin once, and they asked him, George, do you smoke pot on the day of the show to get up for the show? And his answer was, you know, he smoked pot when he got up or something. Or he, you know, when he during that day, and then that show was something he had to do that night. And that's how I felt, you know. It was just like a way of life, and I'd be drinking whether I was working or not. So, yes, to answer the question, yeah, there was always beer or alcohol around, and I usually had it on stage. Sure, it becomes a part of your persona and your whole, you know, your MO, so to speak.
How have your performances changed since giving up drinking?
Well, one thing it does to you is it stuns your emotional growth, and it took an effect on me. I mean, for instance, you kind of were trapped in a mindset of where you started drinking. So I guess, you know, I was maybe 30 years old, but in the mind of an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old to a certain extent. So, I mean, a lot of my humor was maybe a little bluer when I was, you know, was drinking. It was more reactionary. I mean, I would make fun of things that when I quit drinking, I kind of started taking up. Like, for instance, I'd always, you know, make fun of people who were working out or jogging, you know. A lot of my material had to do with drinking, you know. I mean, like, I read an article in the newspaper that said beer was actually considered a food. I was psyched. Well, for years, people thought I was an alcoholic. Calm down. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And to audiences who are drinking and having a good time, they love it, right? But then when you stop drinking, it's kind of like you're not being true to yourself. So the material kind of started to change. And I just started reading a lot more. And I started to rely on other stimulus to kind of inspire that creativity.
Do you mean like coffee or ideas?
No. I mean like newspapers and radio and news programs, and just started paying more attention to the world and the political climate, and started relying on things that, I mean, I had gone to college and I'd studied, you know, some history and political science and sociology, and that stuff always interested me. So I started to kind of just change in what I felt to be important. Because when I was drinking heavily, everything was about drinking and partying and putting down people who went to health food stores and, you know, health food. And you know, I don't trust a store as soon as you walk in. A man with the physique of this wire comes up to me to tell me that the vegetables look healthy. Yeah, the vegetables look fine. You are in serious trouble. Somebody turns on the fan, you're in orbit. And people are walking around with T-shirts that say, go hike the canyon. Why don't you go home and smoke in bed, will you please? But anyway, my material started to change from attacking health food stores and people who work out and jog and are actually trying to live a better life to kind of some of the political climate, some of the political things that were happening in the world. Like, you know, like when we invaded Grenada. I'm saying, Grenada, what courage. What are you going to take next, Martha's Vineyard? And I started to talk about issues more, as shall we say, grown-up or adult themes.
Well, why don't we pause here, and I'll play something from your forthcoming CD, which is a recording of your one-man show. And this will show a little bit more of your political humor.
I mean, let's face it, folks, with the end of the Cold War, it's no longer a struggle between democracy and communism. Right now, the whole thing is expanding economics. In the old days, the United States would go into a third world country, set up a dictator just to keep those people free. Now, we don't even refer to it as the third world anymore, folks. It's not the third world. No. It's the emerging markets. They're the emerging markets. We're the merging markets. ABC merges with Disney, CBS merges with Westinghouse. Eventually, folks, there's going to be one company running the entire country. You don't pay your phone bill, they tow your car. And if we're not buying something, they have a way of making us feel guilty about it. The economy's not doing very well. And basically, the reason is a serious lack of consumer confidence. That's the problem with the American economy, folks. People lack confidence. People don't lack confidence. People lack money. People in this country are not buying lottery tickets to boost their self-esteem.
That's Jimmy Tingle from his forthcoming CD, Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense, live from the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's performing at the Hasty Pudding through November 4th. We'll talk more with Jimmy Tingle after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Jimmy Tingle. Was there a point where your politics started to really differ from your friends or from your family?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I really didn't get much of my input from them so much as I did from newspapers and articles and journals that I was reading in the company that I was keeping. What I did is I moved from Boston down to New York in 88, and I was there for the next 6 years or so. And so I wasn't really in contact on a day-to-day basis with the how do you think about this, or how do you think about that concerning politics, which took me away from something very valuable, which is just other people that you know and love and their opinions about things. But in another way, it opened me up to more so to the world of just living in another city away from home and more journals and magazines and different types of viewpoints, which was very good. Now I'm living back in Boston. And like, for instance, when I was living in New York, you would see the homeless, but I didn't know any of them. And you would see the police officers, but I didn't know any of them personally. Or you see the firefighters or the postal workers or the teachers, but you didn't know them. Here, I come here, I see the police, I know the police where I grew up and the fire and the guys in the fire department and, you know, the postal workers. So it's a nice feeling. It has a connection that I didn't have in New York. And even some of the homeless, I see that guy, go, hey, I drank with that guy, I drank with that guy, I drank with that guy. it's not necessarily uplifting, but at least it does give you some sort of insight into where these people are coming from. And you see them as human beings rather than, quote, the homeless, quote, the police, quote, the fire department.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you know a pretty diverse group of people, too.
Yes. Yep. Very much so.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Working class, middle class neighborhood. A lot of different types of people. Mostly it's an Irish, Italian, Portuguese, Black, Spanish, Greek, Jewish to a certain extent. Some Protestant, very few, but it was a very mixed neighborhood. Went to public schools. Cambridge is a very diverse place. That's where I grew up. Plus, you had the Harvard and MIT influence, which was just on a different plane altogether. But those people are, you know, mixed. Like, my parents rented rooms. We had Harvard students and MIT students living in our house. My father was in the cab business. He owned his own taxi business, and that was interesting, going every place in a cab growing up. One time he took us hunting in a cab.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that idea.
We pull up to the forest, you know, in a big yellow cab. Animals immediately start goofing on us, you know. Bears are looking out of the forest. Somebody call a cab.
Now, what's the experience been like for you of taking parts of your life and working it into a performance? I mean, it seems to me it gives a great opportunity to kind of take the chaos of your life and shape it and make it into this coherent story, actually a humorous coherent story.
Mm-hmm.
Is it giving you a different take on your life?
Well, you know, most of the stuff I talk about is not particularly positive stuff. I mean, you know, there's nothing really, I mean, they're kind of negative things. I mean, drinking too much is on the face value, it was not a positive thing. But on the flip side of that, what I've gotten in return, it's increased my spiritual life tremendously. It's just given me a clearer head and a direction in life and something I never want to go back to. So it's kind of like a victory of overcoming something that was on the surface a giant negative. So it's kind of a journey, but it's a lot of struggle and just trying to keep going with things like the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings. I mean, you know, when those hearings became public, I was sitting there watching them with the woman I had just started going out with, and I'm watching it, and I'm embarrassed because as they're asking Clarence Thomas questions, you know, Mr. Thomas, did you say pubic hair on the Coke can? And I'm sitting there going, pubic hair on the Coke can? I've said a hell of a lot worse than that. I mean, if I ever went out drinking and said, like, pubic hair on the Coke can, that would be a really good night. The same thing with the homophobia growing up. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't know any gays, or I didn't know anybody that I knew was gay, put it that way. I was petrified of gays, you know? And as I got older and I got to know and become friends with a few gay folks, you know, it became okay. So the homophobia evaporates. Well, it's all a growth pattern and an evolution, a personal journey myself. And I think people identify with that because most people grow up with certain fears, prejudices, narrow thinking. None of us grow up knowing everything, and none of us are ever going to know everything. So it's just a process.
What's it like for you to almost become a character in your own performance? Because I think with the kind of material you're doing, you do become something of a character.
I don't see it that way, but there's a certain detachment, I suppose. I don't detach very well from it, though, I gotta tell you. I mean, when I relive a lot of it on stage, and that adds to the emotional toll that it takes on me. I was saying this to one of the gentlemen at the theater. He says, but Jimmy, now you're an actor. You don't have to get emotionally involved. And I said, I don't know if I am an actor. I mean, I am acting, and I am putting emphasis in certain places, and I am, you know, using inflections to make points, and my voice, and all this sort of stuff, and facial expressions. But the material is very, very close to me personally. So, it allows me probably to be more truthful because I don't allow myself to get away with stuff that isn't true, and even if it's not what you would want, I would want them to think of me. You know, in the course of the show, I show things that are not flattering about myself. And that's just the way it is. But it's the truth. And there is no right or wrong if it's the truth. So, that is kind of difficult. But it's also rewarding because people identify with it.
Hey, in the spirit of fresh air, tell us something unflattering that you discuss on the show.
Well, I mean, just the embarrassedness, like, for instance, you know, growing up homophobic or growing up with, you know, attitudes like the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, and the drinking stuff. I mean, how much stuff do I have to tell? Jeez. Come on, Terry, you're drawing it out of me. What are we, in confession? I'm going back. I'm Father Gross. Excuse me, Mother Gross. Bless me, Mother, if I have sinned.
And we will make it public.
Years. Yeah.
Yes, you have sinned, and we will broadcast it.
Right.
Well, Jimmy Tingle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. It's been a blast.
Jimmy Tingle performs his one-man show at the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, through November 4th. His CD of the show, Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense, will be released next month on the label Lyric Moon. Here's more from the show.
We hear an awful lot about welfare reform. We don't hear anything about wage reform. Everybody wants the people on welfare to work. I say, fine, absolutely. I got a couple of questions. Number one, where? And number two, how much are they going to pay these people? I mean, you could work for the minimum wage in this country, 40 hours a week, and at the end of the month, after taxes, bring home $500. Now, the average cost of an apartment is $600. So you haven't even moved in yet. You're already $100 in debt. But just suppose, folks, you found a place for $400 a month. That would leave you $100 for the rest of the month for food, clothing, and utilities. $100 divided by 30 days comes out to $3.33 a day. I think I'll write a book, America, on $3.33 a day. It'll be very big in Europe. And what does one do with $3.33 a day? Well, you take $1 and open an IRA. You take $2 and put it in a savings account. At 2.5% interest, 3.2% inflation, at the end of the month, you got $1.75.
This is Fresh Air.